Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Thursday, July 27, 2017. It's a very hot day here in Nashville, and we are expecting storms this afternoon. On Wednesday of last week, July 19th, 2017, I recorded an interview with my friend Deborah Pascal. Deborah is a friend of long standing, going back to our days at the Tennessee Department of Conservation. Deborah was not the first woman to work in a responsible job in a Parks and Recreation agency. However, she was among the very first women to serve as a Parks and Recreation director for a small city or town in Tennessee. Deborah has retired from her outstanding work in the establishment of the Wilderness Station as part of the Murfreesboro Parks and Recreation Agency. As you will learn, Deborah has a fascination with butterflies, so much so that she even traveled to the Amazon to pursue her interest. And so Deborah and I got together to discuss her recent trip. Please also note that we have posted several pictures of her trip on our website. I do hope you'll enjoy my interview with Deborah Pascal. And Deb Pascal, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Well, thanks, Mark, and what a nice invite. It's good to be here and good to see you.
Well, it's great to see you also, and it's been so many years since I've seen you. I guess, Deb, you and I first got to know each other probably 78 or 79.
Exactly. It's been a while.
And I'm thinking I was kicking around talking to Bill Boswell one day down at the 2611 West End office of the Conservation Department. And got introduced to you, and I think at that time you were either a seasonal recreator or maybe one of the regional recreators for the state.
I remember that day exactly. I know the moment you're talking about, and yes, I think by then I had been seasonal at Cedars of Lebanon and Fall Creek Falls a couple of summers and had moved into a regional parks and rec, state park recreator.
Right. So you have worked in state parks and in local parks in a couple settings.
Right. I loved the state parks and all the opportunities they offered. But then when I started working with the local municipalities, I realized that was fast lane recreation. That daily recreation was.
It's where the rubber
really,
meets the road.
Oh, it really kept you busy. Yep.
I love that. I should say this too about you, Deb, so that many of the people that listen to this show will know you. Because a lot of the park and recreation people have said that they like to listen to my podcast.
Of course.
But many from around here, but also out of state, will not know you.
Cool, yes.
You graduated from the University of Tennessee.
Correct.
And played basketball at Tennessee.
I did, Lady Vols.
That gives me goosebumps.
Well, that was the pioneer era.
Yeah.
I played the year before Pat Summit started, with Coach Margaret Hudson, okay, who recently passed away with dementia, much okay, like Pat. Okay. It was just a fluke almost. I was a sophomore PE recreation person before I even knew about the team, and okay, happened to walk through the gym and I'd been to see my advisor. I went back to my advisor and I said, "What's this team practicing?" And they said, "Oh, that's the Lady Varsity Basketball." And I said, "Well..."
Which was new at the time when you and I were in school.
It had been around for years, but it disappeared for a while and had come back 2 or 3 years earlier.
Right.
And I said, "Well, I played basketball in high school. What do I do to get on?" And they said, "Go talk to the coach." So I did. I shot a few baskets for her, and she said, "Okay, show up tomorrow."
So you had played high school ball at Gordonsville?
At Gordonsville,
okay,
yes.
Which is a renowned high school basketball power.
Right, they're football, basketball, but softball, girls softball, okay, and baseball. They're big, getting very well known for their sports.
So yeah. Your background in recreation is well earned.
Yeah, yes.
And I've noticed from your Facebook post that you go back to the alumni gatherings of the basketball program.
I do. You know, for years I would see on TV that Pat, Coach Summit, had the alumni over to her house, and I'm like, "Well, I didn't get invited." Okay. Well, at her 25th year celebration, she invited Coach Margaret back, Margaret Hudson. And Coach said, well, I'm not going to come unless my team can come. So that suddenly opened up probably a good 10 years of people prior to Pat being there, okay, or at least 5 years. And so since then, we've all gotten invited to everything. It was just terrific. It was at her house, Pat's house, and so it's
amazing.
Been cool, really nice.
Now, you have recently retired, and I remember that you had been working at Murfreesboro Park and Recreation Department.
Correct.
What was the nature of your job out there?
Well, I was hired on as a therapeutic recreation recreator, okay, and but I had this background in outdoors with state parks, so when the opportunity came around for the city to buy some property out on a creek or river, Lanny Goodwin, my director, came and said, have I got a job for you? So he started sharing with me that the opportunity to develop an outdoor program was going to happen with this park. And I said, well, I'll learn what you need me to learn more about therapeutic, but I can really contribute with the people I know and the background I have in outdoor. So I started the first outdoor recreation program for the city of Murfreesboro, which later became the hub was the Wilderness Station at Barfield Crescent Park. I take pride in naming it the Wilderness Station, along with Lanny, and we kind of created this campground that gave you the illusion of being in the wilderness, as well as this very rough, rocky park, hillside park. So I was there for, I guess it opened 15 years ago.
I'll bet you the staff at MTSU, particularly Bertha Kritzberg, was helpful to you. Huh?
Oh, she was my mentor, Mark. Yeah. I met Bertha when I was working with state parks as a regional and made it a point to swing by Murfreesboro every Tuesday night to take a class by her. And she is the one that actually opened my eyes to nature. What she taught in this class was basically outdoor awareness. She taught the stars and constellations. She taught canoeing. She taught camping. She taught us, introduced us to wildflowers. And just all of these things that were basically just enough to become aware so that we could learn on our own. So then when, when I had the opportunity to develop the Wilderness Station and the outdoor program there, it just seemed natural to call it an outdoor awareness program.
Exactly.
Because that's what we wanted to do, is offer basic introductory type programs for kids from 2 years old to 100.
Okay, so
and it worked really well. Yeah.
That is a real testimony to you. I can remember into Lanny and to Dennis Rainier, who was his predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember the first couple visits I had to the Murfreesboro Park and Recreation Agency in like 1980, and it was pitiful.
It was pretty slim at that time.
Yeah,
it sure was. Just athletic. That was, even in by 96 when I was hired, they were basically all athletic. Some cultural arts and senior citizens programs, but I was the weird man out. I came in teaching about butterflies and bugs, and everybody, all the staff was like, what is she doing, you know? And eventually we all learned, and they all learned, that other communities were doing this kind of programming, and,
right,
and they started realizing, okay,
this
is the environmental side of our business and the conservation side of our parks and recreation, and there's a huge demand,
exactly,
for outdoor recreation.
Well, in your retirement, you have become quite an adventurer. And that's what we really want to talk about today. But
okay,
your interest in butterflies and pollinators,
mm-hmm,
is predominant.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, it has to be a God thing, the way I came across the butterflies. I was at Tennessee Tech one year, kind of thinking about getting out of the recreation business. I was taking some education classes. Must have been the late 80s, and this big butterfly led me down the sidewalk on Tennessee Tech campus, and it just was right in front of me for a long way, and I thought, you know, I want to learn about those. And it was like this epiphany that suddenly I started learning about butterflies. Well, and then I had an opportunity to have a new house, or I had a house moved, which is a whole nother story. And I had a brand new yard, so I was going to create a butterfly garden there. And I started realizing you can't just plant blooming flowers. You have to have host plants, which is what the butterflies lay their eggs on, and the caterpillars eat that plant, and then they pupate and become adults. And so there was this whole series of things I had to learn. So over time, you couldn't find many books. There was nothing online. We didn't have computers yet, really. And so I went to a lot of butterfly houses in Florida. My mom and I would travel to, we went to Branson, Missouri. Branson, Missouri. Yeah. There was a good one there. We went to Callaway Gardens and just learned everything I could about butterflies. But what I couldn't find was what kinds of butterflies were in our backyard. Everything at all of these big butterfly houses were, they were tropical butterflies. And the reason being is in order to keep all their host plants year-round, they had to have tropical plants that weren't deciduous. So I became determined to learn about the butterflies that we see every day and what plants they needed. And from there, I began teaching others. And it bloomed into a career. It was amazing. It was just a godsend, without a doubt.
Well, maybe at the conclusion of the show, we can make some suggestions to people about what would be appropriate in their yards for butterflies.
Absolutely.
But I know in pursuit of your interest in butterflies, you got yourself involved in a trip to South America, and I want to hear about that.
I did. It was around the first week or two in January of this year that I was just scanning Facebook like I do often, like many of us do, and I was already kind of in the mindset to take a trip and, you know, and just kind of was on the lookout for something. And I'm not even exactly sure where this trip announcement came from, but suddenly I see this trip that says Lepidoptera Expedition 2017. And I kind of went back and I went, whoa, wait a minute. What is that about? And it turned out that it was a professor was getting together a small group to come to Peru, the Peruvian Amazon, an area near Puerto Maldonado, which is on the Bolivia and Brazil border.
Okay.
And
way up at the reaches, far end reaches of the Amazon.
Exactly. Yeah. So next thing I know, I'm signed up and planning. I'm getting ready to go. Camping gear and.
Now, who was the host or the promoter of this trip?
It was a professor, Jeff, suddenly I can't remember his name, but he had been affiliated with the University of Florida,
who has
a museum that's just phenomenal, one of the greatest butterfly collections and research facility for butterflies in the country, maybe the world. And so I kind of felt comfortable with the fact that he had been affiliated with them. Sorry, Jeff, I can't remember your last name. Forgive me. But everybody kept saying, well, are you going with a group? Or are you going by yourself? I said, well, no, I'm going by myself to meet a group. And I've never been out of the country before, so that was a...
Really and truly, you didn't have a passport?
I had the passport.
Okay.
I had been through Canada to Alaska.
Okay.
But other than that... I had it ready, and I got, like I said, I was kind of watching,
wow.
All at once, I'm on my way to the jungle, and I'm like, oh my, you
know? Okay, so you embarked to go to South America from where exactly?
Well, I'm from Gordonsville,
right.
Tennessee, and we went through Dallas, and then over to Lima,
okay.
Then to Cusco,
all right.
And then to Puerto Maldonado. They call Puerto Maldonado the... Jungle City, and it was a 24-hour travel day.
Okay.
We flew overnight, of course, but then just getting through Peru to two or three different airports was a very slow process. They don't seem to be on time very much as far, you know, a lot of sitting in the airplane waiting to get off the tarmac. So anyway, but it was good.
So
it was all good.
So you get off the plane and you end up going out into the jungle. And how does that happen?
Well, we were picked up by the host, Professor Jeff, and in a hot, old, beat-up Mercedes van. And I think we had three participants on, maybe four participants, and a cook with us. And we headed about 15 miles up the highway, which I need to tell you about the Interoceanic Highway, which is a paved highway. But and then about 15 miles from the airport, up 15 or 20 miles from the airport, we found ourselves at a farm called Finca La Padre, or La Piedras. La Piedras, Finca meaning farm, the farm at La Piedras. We were going to be on the La Piedras River.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the area that we were in.
Okay. And so then you get on the river.
Well, we stayed at the farm for a couple of days.
Okay.
Oh, man, the humidity was just unbelievable. The temperature was probably only 80, 85. But the humidity day and night was just crucial. And I was kind of prepared for it. But, you know, the first thing I missed was a cold glass of ice water. I drank lots of water, but there was no cold water. There was no ice, of course. So it was very difficult to think about cooling down. But, yes, we were there at the farm where we did some basic training for catching butterflies with the long nets, something I had not done with this particular kind of net. We went out and caught some, and we were taught how to, of course, we had to kill them, which was difficult, but we were collecting for research, and we had to scientifically document and put them in this little envelope to preserve them and get them to different colleges, like the University of Florida, where they will be submitted for DNA and different types of research.
Okay. So you finally got out of the jungle then?
We finally got to the jungle. It took about a 15, 20-minute, 20-mile drive up the highway farther north toward Brazil. Again, we were very close to Brazil and Bolivia, probably as much as 5 to 10 miles away. And then we got off of the highway, and we took a 60-mile four-wheel drive truck ride on a dirt road. Took a two hours. It was like a packed, muddy, red mud road. And then occasionally where the drainage areas were, it was mud, and it was difficult to pass. But we were in these two old, I think they were like Ford Ranger or Eddie Bauer trucks that were double cabbed. And Lord knows how many hundreds of thousands of miles they had on them. But we made it, and I loved it. I loved that drive just as much as anything else. It was just fascinating. And, of course, along the way, we would see these cuts in the forest, like a little drive or a little road that had been cut through the forest, which kind of indicated that there was some logging going on. Or now, it's hard to say if it was legal or illegal, but yeah. But then we get to the river, a little marina, and then we go about 20 minutes upriver, and we get to the Las Piedras Amazon Center, which is a research center.
Okay.
Then we're really in the jungle.
All right.
Yeah.
And how long did you spend there?
Well, two nights at the farm, about four nights at the research center.
Okay.
And then we were on the river for four nights, maybe five, and we went like 100 miles upriver into the heart of the Amazon, the southern part of the Amazon, to a village that was on the edge of what is called the voluntary isolation tribes, meaning that there's still several tribes of natives that are like they've always been, very primitive, and desire to have no contact with the outside world. We were going to the very last village, but when we arrived in Peru, we found out that 5 days prior, the they call them uncontacted. The uncontacted peoples had raided the town of Monte Salvador, and they raided it overnight, basically to get tools, and they get things like pots and pans and machetes. Machetes are invaluable in the jungle. And so we were advised not to come. So we came to, we ended up at the second innermost village, and that was a great experience, but they were a little more modernized. And we were hoping to see this last village that we heard that some would dress like us, some would be in native costume. And it was supposedly a bigger community to the point that it sort of had a had little restaurants, a little food eateries where people could get food, and more like a community of business resident type thing, and must have been a bigger population. So I really hate that we didn't get to do that, but anyway.
All right, well, so you've learned some things about native culture and about South America, but what did you learn about butterflies?
Well, you know, butterflies have to have sun and heat in order to fly. They're solar powered. And that's my, you know, they're cold-blooded, so I like to tell kids they're solar powered. Well, on about the sixth day when we started to head upriver, it got cloudy and misty, and a weather phenomenon called the frajita, I believe I said that right, which is a cold front from the Andes Mountains, came down into the Amazon Valley, and it was already fall, but suddenly it was like, you know, we would have a blackberry winter or something. Suddenly the temperature dropped pretty drastically. So we went from like 80 and 85 with 100% humidity to say 70 and 75 with 79% humidity, which was absolutely perfect for camping and everything else. Right. But the butterflies were not as abundant. So what did we learn about butterflies? I learned that there's a lot of similarities there with the ones that we have, a lot of similar species and families. But then I also saw some that were just so unbelievably different. And but we didn't really discuss it much since we didn't get to pursue that much, as much as we had planned.
Did you see butterflies in the different stages of development, or?
Well, we saw, I saw some, yes, we found one bush on a beach. We would camp on a sandy shoreline of the river, and they called it a beach. And I saw one tree that had all three stages. Apparently the adults had laid eggs at different times. So we saw some eggs, we saw some caterpillars that were still fairly young, and then some were actually pupating into chrysalis. So it was quite surprising to see that much activity on one bush. I have no clue what it was going to become, but yes, we did see that in that one instance.
That's just amazing. So you hadn't been out of the country there. They speak Spanish there, I presume.
They do.
And you were able to conduct yourself pretty well.
Not at all. I was trying to make the effort to learn more, but as it turned out, we had two students that were biology master's degree students from Lima and Cusco, and one young lady, one was a guy, one was a girl. One young lady was pretty fluent in English. She was doing pretty well. And then we had a young lady, a master's student from Albuquerque, and she was very fluent in Spanish. So we all kind of learned from each other. By the end of the week, or 2 weeks, the young man knew more English, and I had picked up on some Spanish. And but we did pretty well. And of course, the leaders were both bilingual, and so they did a pretty good job of translating for us.
Did you have any unique food experiences?
Well, I went over thinking, okay, I'm not going to eat the food, because I didn't want to be sick and start out weak before we had this big, active 2 weeks ahead of us. So I had packed up all of these protein bars, and I probably had 10 pounds of supplemental food, peanuts and eat a snack crackers and all this. But on about the after the first or second day, and probably the fourth or fifth meal, I would go into the kitchen, which was quite a walk, and at the farm, and then I would say, okay, you know, and I would walk back, I'd see what they had, and I would decide that, okay, maybe I don't want to eat this yet. But then one evening I went in and I saw a hot soup, which on a hot day you think, oh no, but it was a hot chicken broth with pasta. And I thought, I can eat that. And the flavor, of course, after eating these dry bars for a few days, was just amazing. But we had a chef. We had a young 24-year-old local guy that had some training, and he was amazing. So after that, I started going to all the meals and also at the LPAC, the Research Center, and the meals were amazingly good. We have lots of rice, of course, and then we would have vegetables in with it. But I didn't eat any meat. I became a vegetarian that week, those 2 weeks.
I guess you wouldn't know what sort of meat it was.
Well, they ate a lot of chicken, but the looks of their chicken, I just, you know, I thought, you know, I don't know. And later there was a situation where we were on the river and we lost a cooler of chicken, and they were all upset because they had three chickens in that cooler. And I never really asked, why do you keep it in a cooler when there's no ice? But I guess it was to keep the critters from it or something. But anyway, I you know, and they had on the boat experience, they took a lot of food, bottled water in the big 5-gallon containers, and we were treated pretty well when it came to food. So I lucked out at that, but now 3 days before I left, I did get the stomach bug and missed out on the tree climbing and one of the activities I was looking forward to.
Yeah, you I guess have to be careful, especially with the water.
Yes, and I think probably what got me is that, you know, we had drinking water, but we were washing our dishes in the river water.
Yeah.
And of course the river water's muddy and because of the soil there and everything else. So I feel like over time, that's probably what got me. However, I did eat fish at the village that we visited, and they had caught it the day before, but they dry it some way. It actually looked like pork chops, and it tasted like pork chops. It was very tasty. So that could have possibly gotten me, but I think it was the long-term thing that just a little bit of everything finally caught up with me, but it wasn't too bad.
Well, Deb, you have taken a lot of pictures, some of which you have shared on the internet, they're just some beautiful pictures of your trip.
Thank you.
Maybe if you will share some of those with me, I can put them up on the website for people to to see.
That would be great.
Nice illustrations of the geographic features where you actually were. And you were mentioning that you were concerned about the threats to the rainforest.
Yes, Mark. I learned a lot about the rainforest in general, but there's many more threats to the rainforest than what we hear about the logging. Of course, there's the illegal logging, but what I didn't know is that there's gold mining that has become a major problem, and they in that process, they clear the property of the trees and just go in with the big graders and
earth-moving
equipment and dig out the soil. They dig out the soil, they sift it, and they move on. So it's very invasive and destructive to the property and to the rainforest. Then they have, there's been Brazil nut harvesting for years, but there's also illegal Brazil nut harvesting that is happening all up and down, all across the Amazon. But the new threat that is increasing all of these other threats is a new highway that connects the Pacific coast to the Atlantic coast. It goes all the way across the continent of South America from Peru over into Brazil, I think down to Rio de Janeiro. And you can see, just the road is going to open up opportunities that weren't available prior to more logging, more gold mining, more Brazil nut harvesting. And then, of course, the thing about it is that it's really needed in terms of for the local people, because it's an opportunity to bring in more goods and services and more ways to make money for the residents. But and it makes it easier for them to travel. But, you know, there's farming, and it could possibly grow into more farming, positive farming, and tourist development and roadside businesses. But the cons of that, of the road, the bad part, is where it opens up this pristine forest area and it makes everything accessible. So suddenly there's squatters that are building communities. There's illegal crime. There's more deforestation. Gas wars. Here you've got 1,100 miles of highway and no gas stations along the way. And all these local folks basically ride motorcycles or four-wheelers of some sort that are like tractors and wagons.
Gas, yeah.
So, and then the local politicians on both countries are pretty well corrupt. And so they've got all these, even these roadside hotels next to toll gate, and yet there's nothing happening in those hotels. They've got a restaurant in some of those places, but nothing's working because it's still too dangerous. There's no law enforcement, so there's a lot of social and cultural problems yet. But it would be a good thing if there was control, but unfortunately, it's just going to open up opportunity for more devastation.
So interesting, Deb, that you chose to go to South America on your first venture out of the country.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy.
Let me just tell you, I've been to Europe several times, and it's just as well organized as we are here, you know.
Yep,
and so
yep.
That's a whole different arrangement.
Well, it seems like tourism, oddly enough and maybe sadly, that it's going to take more people in the form of tourism to actually save the area,
right,
and to save the rainforest. Once there's already a big move, a pretty good obvious movement toward ecotourism, and a lot of rainforest resorts are popping up. But there's one here called The Last Resort that has been there for a while, and it's very plush and like $300 or $400 a night, and really far up in the jungle. And I met people on the plane also that were going to these resorts where their windows would open right out into the jungle. So it's already happening, but I think more and more the local people, just the general residents, like the village people that we visited, are learning that they too are going to have to get tourist friendly in order for economic income to come to them.
Right.
And so that's an interesting take on.
So you saw some interesting wildlife when you were there.
We did. We saw a capybara, which is kind of a groundhog-looking type critter, and some great birds. We were along the river a lot. I can't pronounce the name of this one, but it's like H-O-A-X-I-N or something, but it's a really cool-looking bird with these spike feathers on its head. We just saw all kinds of cool stuff. We had a river boat incident that I haven't mentioned. I don't know how our time is, but that was an adventure. Our boat, our boat got hung on a rock and almost turned over, but we were off of it.
I'm looking at the boat that you were on the river in, and it's an open boat with a. It had a cover on top, but the sides were open.
Right.
Not a deep drafted boat at all, like an oversized rowboat.
Right. It's a wooden boat, all wooden and handmade. But what was happening, most of the river was all flat and no rapids or ripples. And we get to this one place called Death Rapids. And they had told us that it was, you know, going to be a little rough, but they put us out on this bank, a muddy bank, and all of us got off but the cook and the boat driver. And so they took a couple of passes up the river, and normally they'd go in the middle where there was a downstream V, if you know about rivers. And but there was a log had washed in, so they had to take a different route and get over next to the far shoreline. Now, this was pretty far away from us, and my pictures are zoomed in. But here we are, the young leaders are trying to figure out what to do, and one said, well, I'll wade across. And I'm like, you can't wade across that heavy current. He goes, yeah, I guess you're right. So then he and the other, the LPAC director, Jeff and the LPAC director decide they'll go upstream a ways and swim across. So they do. And they managed then to work their way back to the boat, down to where the boat is. Well, here I am on the bank thinking, oh, great, you know, visions of Gilligan's Island, and and I'm thinking, okay, our leaders are in the water that has piranhas in it, and our boat is across the river, almost turning over with all of our food and water, and it really was a moment of panic, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been, because it happened to be that there were two boats there where we were standing on the bank, and that was a sign of Brazil farmers. One of the boats had a motor and the other didn't. So a man comes down out of the woods, and we're going, oh, help us, you know, of course, speaking in Spanish. And he said the driver of the boat that has the motor wouldn't be back for 2 or 3 hours. Well, here we are. It's an hour till dark. It gets dark promptly at 5, and so we're thinking, oh, brother. So Victor, the boat driver, our boat driver, swims across. Now, he's probably 65 or more. He swims across the river and gets one of these boats that doesn't have a motor, and then uses the pole, the big long pole, to get across back to the stranded boat. Well, and we're thinking, he can't get across that current with that pole, but he knew what he was doing, so sure enough. So they the guys and the two kids, the two students that he took with him, they all transferred our food and our clothing and everything out of the boat that was ours and into the second boat that belonged to the Brazil farmers, and managed to get it back to the muddy side of the river, the shoreline. So we had to survey what was hurt, what was damaged, what wasn't. I looked, and the students were going through the eggs, you know, here's some eggs are good, some aren't. And then they were really concerned about losing the 3 chickens in the cooler. And I'm like, well, you know, what's the deal? But we had lost some food, and we were on our first day of our adventure, so it really was a little confusing. So, but this little cook, he had been in on all this adventure and of the part of having to be on the boat on the other side of the river. And he had been involved in the whole thing. He still was back and had our dinner ready by 7 o'clock.
Oh my goodness.
And so he was a hero there. So it was tense at the time. And by the time dinner rolled around, one of the Peruvian students broke out his little Bluetooth radio, which normally I would have not wanted to hear music in a place like that. But suddenly it lightened the mood.
Right.
So we'd like, woohoo, you know, we made it. You know, this is their first real adventure. And so we spent that night on a mud bar. And so I had mentioned, I had heard that you had to be careful when you camp close to the water, because the water could come down because of the rainforest and rain and all. It could rain upstream, and the water would rise. So I made sure that everyone was aware of that and reminded the leader that, hey, you know, maybe you should keep an eye out for this. So he did, and it did rise about 6 inches, but nothing to worry us. But I was wanting everyone to know that if they got awakened in the middle of the night going, ah, the water's rising, you know, that they would be prepared. So
Ted, we're approaching 38 minutes here, so
okay.
we're not going to have much more time. If you would share some of these pictures with me, I will make sure that they get posted to the internet site.
Absolutely,
so
I would love to.
So can take a look at them.
I would love to.
But,
and this is just, the pictures are just a highlight. I tried to put together a slide presentation of the highlights of the, we were at four different locations, so it's been a hard, been a lot to tell and talk about, but
I understand
it was fabulous.
That you're making a presentation tonight.
Yes.
Of your trip with slides. In fact, a friend of mine has told me that that she's planning to go, so you may meet a friend of mine there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Music City Fly Girls group.
Correct.
That you're involved with, and
right.
This is a group of fly fisher women.
Fly fishing anglers, yes.
Anglers,
yes.
Okay, all right.
And yes, we have a wonderful group of ladies that are kind of headquartered out of the Caney Fork, which is up around Gordonsville, where I'm from, and we meet once a month and at the Knights of Columbus near the airport. And so, yes, it's my night to talk about the jungle instead of hearing about some latest fishing adventures. One week we had a lady share with us her fishing trip to Patagonia.
Oh, my.
So
you didn't do any fishing in the Amazon?
We didn't. Okay. It was just, there was just too much to do, you know,
exactly.
And too much gear to deal with, yes.
Exactly. Deb, just in the next couple of minutes that we have, what is your advice to the home gardener that is interested in attracting butterflies?
Well, you know, I think one thing I've noticed, even in my small town, is people aren't planting flowers much. So even to have nectar plants, blooming nectar plants, is a huge thing. Beware of nursery plants. They're going to have some pesticides on them. If you can plant seeds, that's great.
Not just on them, but in them
as
well.
In them, yes.
Yeah.
So planting from seeds is kind of important. And don't worry about, you know, find a place that doesn't have to look perfect and just plant some flowers. That's the first step. Give the adults some food to attract them into our area. Then, you know, there's host plants for each different species, for instance. But one easy thing is like parsley attracts the eastern black swallowtail. Spice bush is kind of a hard bush to find, but it attracts a beautiful spice bush swallowtail. Just get online and learn your native plants and look up host plants for specific butterflies. And just learn those native plants and don't be afraid to plant native plants in your garden. Or like I said, have an area that you're not worried about being so perfectly cultivated. Make it in your backyard even, and until you learn more about those plants. I had a certified backyard habitat with butterflies in the early 2000s, I guess. I had a new house and new yard, and it's just been great joy. And you to watch the eggs, the adults lay the eggs, and then they turn to caterpillars, and you can bring them in and kind of protect them from the birds if you prefer. However, raising caterpillars is a tremendous amount of labor. It's amazing. Very laborious.
Make sure you've got something for them to eat at all times.
Food, water, and changing. They eat, they drink, they poop, you know. You've got to keep the plants moist and the container kind of moist. And you've got to make sure they've got fresh food. And the more they eat, the more they poop. And you have to clean that out of a container. It really is like taking care of a child. But it's so rewarding. It's amazing.
And some of the host plants are not necessarily that special. I mean, you have the milkweed and some of these others that don't make necessarily attractive garden flowers as such, but still they're necessary for these butterflies
right.
to continue life
There's
cycle.
One of the easy, well, it may take a second year for them to grow, but the butterfly weed, which is part of the milkweed family, is really pretty in your garden, in your landscaping. And then another thing, you have to realize that these plants are going to be eaten. But something like the butterfly weed, it totally regrows all of its leaves within about 2 weeks. It's amazing. That's another, the stem can be just stripped, and then in about 2 weeks it looks normal again.
Same is true of parsley.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've had parsley decimated by caterpillars, and it just looks like the plant will never survive, but it does just fine.
Exactly, and the The butterfly weed is also a host plant for the monarchs, like the milkweed. So
you just have to plant enough for them and you as well.
Exactly.
Well, Deb, it's been a treat to have you visit with us today.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
Do share some of your pictures, and I'll promise to get them on the internet where folks can see them.
That sounds great.
All right. Thanks, Deb.
Thanks, Mark. I really appreciate it and enjoyed being with you.
All right. Thank you.